You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the National League East for MLB.com Extras. We start with the surprising Philadelphia Phillies and our MLB.com Phillies reporter, Todd Zalecki. Todd, the Phillies starting to look pretty good on the mound. Some great pitching performances as far as the starters go, but we got to start here as we record this on Thursday afternoon, talking about some negative news. Story broke just this morning. Daniel Stumpf suspended 80 games for testing positive for a PED. The 25-year-old left-hander hadn't pitched great so far this season, but what kind of a hit is this to this Phillies team at this point in the season?
Well, it is in the sense that he's a Rule 5 draft pick, and they're hoping to get him as much work as possible. Just to kind of get an evaluation from him now, you could also look at it from another point of view and say, well, he suspended 80 games. It doesn't count. It doesn't hurt them in terms of his Rule 5 status. And you know sometimes how hard it is to keep a Rule 5 guy on the roster the entire season. But basically, the Phillies don't have to have him on a 25-man roster for the next 80 games. So he's eligible to return July 10th. And then if you look at it even further, you could say, all right, rosters expand September 1st. So if he comes back July 10th, now instead of having to kind of keep him on the roster, you know, 5 months out of the season, they basically only would have to keep him on the roster from July 10th through August 31st. And then, like I said, once rosters expand, it's really kind of a moot point. So not good, obviously. You don't want to have any player get suspended for an anabolic steroid. The Phillies are definitely disappointed. I talked to one of his teammates, James Russell, today. He says everybody's really surprised by it. He could still remain in the organization beyond this year upon his return from his suspension.
It is really an interesting viewpoint to look at it as far as the Rule 5 status, because I know in the past there's been some times with the Rule 5 guys and some teams, guys mysteriously end up on the disabled list throughout the season and to be able to stay part of the Major League club. I know none of that is – it's all kind of done, and this is an interesting way to do it because, as you said, the guy would have had to have been on the roster all year long, and now they kind of miss half of that. But like you said, in the long run, overall, this isn't a good story for the Phillies. So let's turn the page and get to some of the good news for this Phillies team, and that is suddenly some great starting pitching. The last two games, a shutout followed by a 2-1 win. Let's start with Wednesday night and Jared Eichhoff. 7 innings, 9 strikeouts, 7 scoreless innings, and from what everything I've heard, the curveball was untouchable.
Yeah, he pitched great last night against the Padres, the other night against the Padres, and this is a guy who the Phillies are really excited about. You know, when they acquired him as part of that Cole Hamels trade, he was basically the number 4 guy in that 5-player deal. The top 3 guys were Jake Thompson, Jorge Alfaro, and Nick Williams. And you know, people said, Eichhoff's pretty good. He's got some potential, maybe a bottom of the rotation type of guy. But he made 8 starts last season for the Phillies. I think his ERA was 2.65. He pitched great and got the coaching staff last season really, really excited. And his teammates last season loved him. I remember one of the best quotes I got all last season was from Jeff Francoeur. He says, "I have a huge man crush on Jared Eichhoff," because he's kind of a guy, he's got a bulldog personality on the mound. He works fast. He's aggressive, you know, and players in the field love a guy like that. You know, there's not that 35-second delay in between pitches. He gets the ball, he throws it, and again, he's aggressive. And this start yesterday is a kind of a continuation of that. And even his first start of the season last week against the Mets, he allowed 2 earned runs in 5-plus innings. And that was really some of his first action of the year because he missed a lot of time early in camp because of a broken right thumb. But really, Jared Eichhoff, make a long story short, the Phillies are really encouraged what they have with him so far, and they are hoping that he could be kind of a surprise acquisition or a surprise piece of this rotation going forward.
Joe, a big win for the Marlins to kick off a series with the Mets on Monday night. After a 1-3 first week of action after they dropped a couple games to the Tigers and then split a series with the Nationals, a rain-shortened series with the Nationals. Let's start with Monday night since that was a real good one for this Marlins team. Chance to go out. They got on Steven Matz, the Mets starter, early on and often. They put up some run. They hit some homers. Were the Marlins waiting for kind of a win like that, a nice, easy, I don't want to say easy win, but a win where they jumped out in front early and were able to cruise?
Well, it was really the first game this year they had a little bit of breathing room. Now, they got it with a 7-run second inning, and then there was a struggle to get Jared Cozart through 5, and he wasn't able to do that. So that was kind of the downer of the night, that their starter still couldn't, you know, go 5 innings for a variety of reasons. But, you know, it was a good win. You know, the bullpen came up, had a 4 or so innings, 3 3-2-thirds, whatever it was, to wrap it up. And they hit. And I think this team is going to hit. And they've got, you know, obviously with Stanton in the middle, he looms large. So D. Gordon looks like he's going to have another really good year. And Yelich is emerging. And if Ozuna could get going in the 2 spot, you know, at that first 4 is pretty formidable. So especially if there's traffic on base in front of Stanton. So we kind of saw that, you know, killer instinct. And Kim, you know, just talking Stanton postgame and, you know, noting difference last year to this year. Last year they may have just got 1 or 2 in that inning. And next thing you know, the Mets are rallying back and it's going to be a tight game. Maybe they pull it out, maybe they blow it. This year, you know, they just feel a little more polished, a little more of that, you know, let's get those add-on runs, let this offense really function and not be satisfied or not find ways to get ourselves out of big innings, but find ways to kind of, you know, get the big inning going for us. So, you know, part of the cultural change that they talked about, you know, since the hiring of Don Mattingly.
They get a couple of home runs on Monday after having just 2 homers in their first 4 games. So that was good to see Stanton now with a couple on the season. So that win, Joe, really sets the stage for a great matchup on tonight, Tuesday, as we record this podcast. You have Noah Syndergaard going for the Mets and Jose Fernandez for the Nationals, 2 of the game's brightest young stars in New York City. Do you expect it to be an electric atmosphere at Citi Field tonight?
Yeah, I do. It's, you know, I was excited about this matchup, you know, just doing the preview and then kind of doing the research on it, and seeing that Syndergaard's averaging like 98 miles an hour with a sinker, which is completely unheard of. And he's got that, you know, 92 mile an hour, was it a slider, I think it is. Or it's, you know, it's like this guy is, you know, one of the premier power arms in the game. And then and Jose comes off a loss in his first start. He's hooked out 13 in one of the weirdest, you know, performances I saw, because Jose was like really good, and yet he got tagged for 5 runs. So, whenever he's on the mound, the Marlins certainly like their chances. So you got 2 really premier, as you said, young, you know, heart-throwing guys who get you excited. You know, a lot of times April pitching matchups, you try not to get too, oh, my gosh, you know, you see Kershaw, Bumgarner out west, and that's always fun. You know, yeah, I kind of hope some of that happens here. You know, the Syndergaard-Fernandez matchup kind of draws that type of electricity.
We're always talking about StatCast here at MLB.com, and I learned a new term yesterday, Joe, plate time, which is kind of a combination of velocity of a pitcher and then how far away from home he lets go of the baseball. And you know, the taller guys obviously benefit. Fernandez and Syndergaard, numbers 1 and 2 in baseball as far as starters go, which basically means that not only are their fastballs fast, but they seem even faster because of the way they're able to extend and get the ball out there.
You know, that's a great point, Tim, and it's something interesting because Carter Capps, of course, had the Tommy John surgery, but a lot's made of his delivery and that kind of hop, you know, seeming hop towards home plate. And everyone, like, said, oh, that's an illegal pitch because he's disengaging from the rubber. Well, if fans look closely, pretty much everybody does. It's impossible. You can't throw the ball remaining on the rubber. And Jose, as noted, is notorious for that. He just doesn't have the hop. He just, the force of his, you know, his delivery and, you know, the pushing up of the back leg gets that drag, they call it. And yeah, it was a really good story by Mike, in noting that. And obviously, the closer, I mean, 60 feet, 6 inches, but you get it even closer to home plate and that to the hitter, that pitch seems like he's coming down about 50, you know, 55 feet or whatever it ultimately is. I don't have a number off the top of my head. And that also 96, you know, is really like 101, you know. So very fascinating stuff as we learn more about the sport and, you know, we'll learn more about spin rates and why hitters think, you know, when you see a hitter swing at a ball that's clearly off the plate and the fans are yelling, how could he swing at that? Well, because it looked like it was a fastball right on the outside of the plate. And the spin rate deceives the hitter. That's the whole objective. So fascinating time with the technology, a fun time to be part of it here at MLB.com and see all that. But, again, you know, two really good pitchers, and we're learning more and more about all these guys.
You mentioned Fernandez's first start being weird, and I had actually written down that exact same word on my notes, weird. For him to be so dominant with the 13 strikeouts and just 5 2/3 innings, what went wrong to allow the 5 earned runs? Was he just missing spots at times and guys were taking advantage?
Tim, he had 5 straight strikeouts. I think he just at one point retired 9 in a row, and yet he was trailing the whole game.
Yeah.
And part of it's his own undoing. I mean, he's throwing 97 by Jared Soltomaki after he gets a walk in the second inning. And clearly you can see Soltomaki is having a hard time catching up with the fastball. And he goes to with a breaking ball. And he hangs it at 84, and it's knocked out for 2-run home. So there he was pitching like that for a while. And then his final inning, Mickey got him for a single, and he had some traffic on the bases. And a real good, I think it was J.D. Martinez got him, hit the ball into the gap for a double. He was out of the game. So he's out of the game with 2 outs, down 3. Dustin McGowan gives up a 2-run double to Soltomaki. Those runs all go on to Jose's stat sheet. So, you know, the bullpen didn't pick him up there. He made his own mess, so you can't have complete, sympathy for the starter when you leave that kind of traffic and expect the guy to pick you up. But very kind of a deceptive, yet the numbers are the numbers. I mean, that day, Anibal Sanchez, whom Wild fans are very familiar with from his days in Miami, pitched real efficiently, and got not as many strikeouts, not the big buzz, but he got deeper into the game. So what I'm looking for from Jose, he kind of pitched like old Jose, where dominant fastball and try to strike out with breaking balls. I think 8 of his 13 strikeouts are on breaking balls. I think that kind of the mission this year, and we've talked about it, is kind of tone down that fastball, live at 94, 95, have 97 to 99 in your pocket, and get some early contact. Get a few easy outs. Get at least one 6-pitch inning in there and have the strikeout there when you need it. And that all is in a perfect world if you could draw it up. And let's not forget, the Detroit Tigers are among the best, one of the best offensive teams in the game. So, that isn't every day, every lineup you're going to see all the time, the damage they can do. So, but again, it was a fascinating outing by Jose. And like you said, weird, bizarre. The line didn't completely tell the story.
Mark, not the start the Atlanta Braves wanted to get off to in the 2016 season. As we record this podcast, they're sitting at 0-7. I guess the bright note on that would be that they've been in most of those games. They had chances to win a lot of those games, but so far nothing in the win column as they're 0-7. And then more bad news on Tuesday morning as we learn that Hector Olivera arrested after allegedly assaulting a woman in D.C. where the Braves are playing right now. What do you know about the Olivera situation as we record right now?
Well, we do know that Hector Olivera was arrested. As you said, this is just a few hours ago at about 7 a.m. Braves officials were alerted that police were there to arrest at the team hotel Hector Olivera, who allegedly assaulted this woman who he's had a previous relationship with. In other words, he certainly did know. We do not know the extent of the relationship. At this point in time, Hector has been placed on administrative leave. He's on the restricted list. We do not know how long he will how much time he will miss. MLB officials will investigate the matter and see how it applies to the joint domestic violence policy, which was obviously instituted last year. So this is certainly a serious issue. To add to that, obviously it affects, how the Braves will move forward, in at the left field position. This could mean that Malik Smith spends more time up here than anticipated. He came up on Monday to replace Ender Inciarte. At that point in time, it looked like he'd be up for just a couple weeks. If Olivera is still on the restricted list, but an Inciarte comes off the disabled list, there's a chance that Malik Smith will stick around and maybe he plays center field. Inciarte goes over to right, and Nick Markakis goes to the left. There's a lot of different options, but one way or another, Malik Smith may fit in that equation.
Obviously, this is a much bigger issue than just baseball, but the Braves went out and made the trade for Oliveira, and they were hoping for big things from him. When you look at what he's done so far with the Braves, taking this, obviously this is bad, and you don't know when he'll be back, but has his time in Atlanta been disappointing already on the baseball field, would you say, beyond this incident?
No, there's no doubt about it. You know, this issue just adds to the many that the Braves have faced since they acquired him. And, you know, look, people will look back at that trade. When it was made, there was a lot of criticism saying, how can you give up your top prospect and a controllable young starting pitcher, top prospect being Jose Peraza, the controllable pitcher being Alex Wood. You know, in the 6 to 8 months, however long it's been since that trade was made, and Peraza's stock has dropped, and then people are starting to say, well, maybe the Braves were wise to trade Alex Wood. My thinking on this is it still comes down to what the returns you've got, and Hector Oliveira certainly has not lived up to anyone's expectations, including those of the members of the Braves organization. So you can go ahead and look and say that Peraza's stock has dropped and Wood's stock has dropped, but at the same time, had they stayed in the Braves organization, would that stock have dropped in this manner? In other words, if the Peraza had stayed, you know, hadn't been traded twice, but people could say, had the Dodgers not tried to trade him twice, and, you know, eventually getting it done this winter, you know, would he be looked at the same as he is right now, same with Alex Wood, had he been to start in Atlanta's rotation? So I think it all comes back to what the return was. You had significant value in those two players. Did you get significant value back? It doesn't look like it right now. So this is a trade that, even if Peraza and Wood don't live up to what we thought they might at this point last year, it's still a trade that could haunt the Braves because they did not get really anything in returns thus far. And, you know, you can't completely – we don't know what the future holds for Hector Oliveira, but right now it's certainly a trade that does not look favorable for the Braves.
Yeah, and you're never going to win every trade, and obviously the Braves have made some other trades in the last year that they've been praised for, and that system is obviously in very good shape now with a lot of young talent on the way. I wanted to talk about one of the young players for this team because you mentioned it, Malik Smith getting the call up for Ender Inciarte, and Malik Smith is a guy, he's not one of those top prospects in this organization, but he's a guy that as a fan, I think you really got to like the way he plays the game, and he's a fun guy off the field as well. I know you got to deal with him in spring training. Now that he's in the major league clubhouse, he took a helmet off the face, I know, in his first game and had to leave the game, which is just kind of injury to insult. But him being up with the major league club, what does he bring to that clubhouse as an energetic guy, and what have you seen from him on the field?
You know, he's a guy that, like you said, he brings some energy to that clubhouse. He's a threat once he gets on base. He's still a little bit raw. He probably could benefit from another 30, 40, 60 games at the minor league level. But at the same time, this team needs him now. He is their best option. Growing up, he was more of a football guy. So he didn't play as much baseball. So he's 23 years old. Maybe you look at it and say, from a baseball development standpoint, he's 21, 22 years old, just the amount of baseball he's played. But the strides he's made over the past year, you can see that he's heading in the right direction. I look at him as, it's not exactly the same, but he's a little bit like Billy Hamilton with shoulders. I'm not trying to say there's a lot of pop in that bat, but there's a little bit. He's got that same kind of speed, but as he grows, I think he'll be able to drive a little bit. He'll have a little bit more pop in that bat than Billy Hamilton will. So a guy that can bring in some offense. One of his second game here at the big league level, he was, causing some havoc on the base. That's not necessarily from stolen bases, but you know, you can see the pitchers react to him a little bit different when he's on base. So that always helps. There's something unique about this guy. Even when he left that game the other night, and he said, it's too bad you had to leave. He goes, wow, I got a unique story. And, you know, I've got a scar here for the rest of my life. And people say, well, where did you get that? And he said, my very first major league game. So, he's an upbeat guy. He makes you laugh. And I think some way, somehow, he's going to – I don't know how the story's going to unfold, but it's going to be a good one for Malik Smith.
Anthony, I feel like it's our duty here to get out there and let Mets fans know that it's still going to be okay, that they can, you know, get off the ledge. It's fine. It's a tough start. It happens. It's baseball. I'm right, right? Things are going to be okay?
I don't know, Tim. I mean, I drove to the ballpark today, and the sky was actually falling. You know, the season, I don't even know why they're bothering to play today. The season's over. No, of course it's fine. Look, they've played six games as of us recording this podcast. They're 2-4. They're on a three-game losing streak. You know how many three-game losing streaks they had last year? Eight. It's going to happen, and because it winds up happening the second week of the season, people flip out a little bit. But the truth is they've played 3.7% of their season. That's the equivalent of an NFL team being early in the second half of their first game. So to draw reasonable conclusions out of any individual player, and certainly out of the team itself, is just it's irrational to try to do it this early in the season. You can't do it, for better or for worse. I would be saying the same thing if they were 6-0, if they were 0-6, or anything in between. And look, I get why people want to look at this team and say, oh, they're not living up to expectations, blah, 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 because through six games, they're not. You know, the pitching hasn't been what we expected for the season. The hitting hasn't been what we expected. But all it takes is really one good game to turn all of that around in a hurry, in a heartbeat. There are 156 of them left. So let's all take a couple sizable steps away from the ledge before we start dooming this team.
I think the one thing that has hit people is the fact that they just lost a series to the Phillies. I think that's one thing that stands out, because everybody expected, hey, the Phillies are going to be the team that you can just beat up on all year long. The Phillies and the Braves, they'll go 18-0 against both of them. And obviously that's not going to happen. And the Phillies have some decent young starting pitching that pitched pretty well, and they lost that series. How about this? The Mets obviously had a roller coaster ride of a season last year. How much does this young team, how much are they able to look back and take from that? When they do hit rough patches this season, and obviously we mentioned that the first one just came a little early, how much can they draw upon the experience they gathered last season?
Well, a lot, and that's something that David Wright actually said the other day on Sunday after a loss, was that, look, you know, it's not an ideal situation because we'd rather be 6-0, as would any team in baseball, but we know firsthand that getting off to not the greatest start isn't the end of the world. You know, Mets fans like to point to the 11-game winning streak that the team had last April, and yeah, that was great, but then you looked up in mid-June and they were a game under 500. You looked up at the end of July, the last week of July, they were one game over 500. So it was a really long, slow, really four-month slow start to the season for the Mets last year. Then they turned it on in August and September and went on to accomplish and achieve everything that they did. I think certainly the Mets can look at that and say, hey, you know, we don't need to be the best team in baseball in April. We don't need to be the best team in the division in April. As long as we are over the long six-month haul, when every team's not just, you know, starting lineup and starting five come into play, but the depth and just the, you know, what you get from playing every single day, you know, those three at-bats, four at-bats piling up, and you get a better sense of what these players are and what they can accomplish and you know, what these young pitchers are capable of doing every time through the rotation. The Mets are still brilliantly set up for the length of this season. It's a long summer, and again, we're 3.7% of the way through the season. There's another 96.3, if my math is correct, to go. So it's just time to calm down and take a look at the talent that's still on this roster and know that, hey, this team did it before and they can do it again.
You mentioned the starting pitching hasn't been great so far. Noah Syndergaard was great in his start in Kansas City, but Steven Matz on Monday night really struggled. An inning and two-thirds, six hits, seven earned runs. He walked a couple batters. What was off exactly with Matz against the Marlins?
Well, he just wasn't making the pitches he needed to make. You know, actually, in the first inning, he was great, and then he came out in the second inning and wasn't able to put the ball where he wanted to put it. Two walks to lead off the inning is never a good thing. And then I'll give the Marlins hitters some credit because they actually hit a couple of pretty good pitches in there. But Mats was getting ahead of pitchers, strike one, sometimes even strike one and strike two, and just not able to locate that pitch, that out pitch where he needed to do. Marlins are a very good hitting team. I think they may be more of a thorn in the Mets' side all summer long than people might expect heading into the season. But for Mats, it's just one of those games that you almost have to throw out and pretend it never happened. This guy is supremely talented, and we forget that he has, I believe, 10 big league starts under his belt going into last night's start. So things like this are going to happen. It's almost easy to forget that it happened for Noah Syndergaard, too. It took him more than 10 starts into his big league career to really hit his stride and become what he's already become. Matt Harvey, maybe not as much, but he still had his growing pains as a rookie season. It really happens to pretty much everyone. This is the first truly bad start of Steven Matz's career, and I do think he'll rebound from it, unless it becomes a trend where you're looking at 3, 4, 5 of those in a row. I don't consider anything to worry about.
As tough a start as it's been for the Mets so far, 2-4, there's one great joy that we can always look for on this team, and that's Bartolo Colon, who did it again. Willie Mays style over the shoulder grab in the infield. What is it about this guy that he's just, I mean, these are plays that happen in baseball, but somehow if he's involved, they just become these special moments that everybody in the country is talking about.
Well, go back and look at the replay, Tim, and you'll see he'll catch that ball and he looks up and he's just got this big grin on his face. This guy loves playing baseball. He smiles more than anyone in the clubhouse, probably combined. I mean, he just is always seems to be in a good mood, and I think that plays into it. People feed off that type of energy. He truly is, you know, we talk about David Wright all the time as being a leader in the clubhouse. Bartolo Colon is right up there with him in terms of a guy that other players gravitate to. And, you know, if you want a little bit of a serious answer, too, this guy's in better shape than we give him credit for, by and large. I mean, yes, you know, he's got a couple extra pounds on him, or more than a couple, I should say. But he works really hard on his defense. He has actually worked in the past year really hard on his hitting, which showed last year. It wasn't a fluke or a mistake that he wound up being a much better hitter last year than he was in his first year with the Mets. He's an athlete, and don't let the body type or the extra, you know, LBs fool you. This guy works hard at his craft, works diligently at his craft, and you pretty much have to, because at his age, 42, you couldn't be a successful big league pitcher, which he is, without working very hard and very diligently at it.
Bill, pretty good start to the season for the Nationals, and I think it's something that they needed to get off to when you look at the schedule, playing the Braves 2 out of the first 3 series, and then they'll have the Phillies as well. When you looked at this schedule kind of heading into the season, was that important, you think, to this team to get rolling early when you look at the teams they'd be facing here in April?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, they have to win the majority of these games. And Dusty Baker even admitted that most of these games in April count. And he wants to say, we won these games. He don't want to say a few months later, we should have won those games. So, yes, they are very important games. And they should win big. They're playing second division clubs. And if they don't win, they're in trouble.
Yeah, the National League's interesting because when you look at every division, it seems like there's three teams that I would say feel like they can compete and can contend and can be in the race. And then there's a couple teams that you feel like those three teams need to kind of beat up on if they're going to get to the playoffs. And the Nationals starting the year with one of those streaks. When you look at the players, Bill, that are off to good starts on this team, Bryce Harper is on the verge of his 100th career home run. I believe if he gets it in the next week or so, he'll be the 7th youngest of all time. Has he talked at all about that milestone and what it might mean to him?
No, he really hasn't. The thing he has talked about was, you know, how he wants to win a World Series. That's the main thing he's talked about. And, you know, he obviously wants to win big time. And the thing is, though, he's off to a good start now, hitting over 350, only has one strikeout. That's pretty good. And I tell you, the guy's been amazing the last 2 years for sure.
Yeah, picking up right where he left off in his MVP season in 2015. Whenever you start a new season, you like the new guys on the roster to get off to a good start. I think it's just good as far as fans instantly kind of liking guys as well as guys fitting in. And Daniel Murphy has certainly done that. What have you seen from Murphy? Because we're seeing that power that kind of came on late last year because he's hit the ball out of the park already this season.
I think what's good about that is that he doesn't strike out much either. I mean, that was one of the reasons they picked him up, because last year they had too many strikeouts on the team. And another thing that's surprising, he's playing some good defense, and hopefully that will keep up. He doesn't have the reputation of being a good defender. But I'm telling you, right now, offensively and defensively, he's really helped carry this team. And I would say after Bryce Harper, he has to be the MVP the first week of the season.
So those guys that are really hitting the ball well, there have been some struggles from some guys in the lineup. I know one, Jason Wirth, started the season 0-for-13, got a key bloop single on Sunday. Is that kind of the type of thing that can get a guy rolling early in the season?
Listen, I'm not worried about Jason Wirth. Jason Wirth will get it. I know he's 36 years old, but he'll get it together. This is a guy who works the count. I think more than anything, he should be their leadoff hitter right now. Now that Ben Revere is on the DL. But we'll see how that goes. And if Michael Taylor can't get it going, they need to put Jason Wirth there because he's the best guy, best suited for the leadoff spot.
I was going to say, Taylor's another guy that struggled. Obviously, this is a big opportunity for him with Revere on the disabled list. He's going to get that regular time. So far, hasn't really got it done at the plate. I know he had an error as well last night. Is he running out of chances to prove that he's more than a fourth outfielder? I know he's still fairly young.
No, he's not running out of chances. I mean, there's still plenty of time. We've got to give this guy a break. Last year, you talked to Mike Rizzo about it. He was rushed to the big leagues. Now they think it's about that time where he can really get it going. I think I'm going to give him some time here, but I just don't think he's a leadoff hitter. I think he's best suited from the sixth order in the lineup on down. And that's about it. I don't think he's a leadoff hitter at all.
Yeah, they've kind of maybe forced him into that spot. How about Wirth as a leadoff hitter? What makes him fit that role?
He works the count, and he always takes a lot of pitches. And, I mean, look at the stats. I mean, he hit over like 380 hitting leadoff last year. Now, he had a bad year overall, but as a leadoff hitter, he had a 380 on-base percentage. So I think he should be... That's the number one reason he should be the guy up top.
Bill, they've hit the ball well. They've also pitched the ball pretty well. Scherzer's been good. Strasburg's been good. Ross was really good. I know Tanner Roark struggled a little bit, but you're rarely going to go through a stretch where all five starters throw gems in a row. Overall, as this starting rotation kind of gets into the feel of the regular season, are all those guys feel like they're on pace right now?
Yes, I think they're on pace. One person I'm kind of concerned about is Gio Gonzalez. Gio Gonzalez hasn't pitched in a long while. He's going to pitch today, which is Wednesday. And I'm just telling you right now, you just hope that he hasn't pitched in like 2 or 3 weeks. So you hope that he can really get it together when he faces the Braves.
Yeah, and he's a guy that if there's an issue with Gio, it's usually the control. Is that another reason to have some concerns after some time off? Because I think that's something that you kind of lose a little bit when you haven't pitched in a while.
Kim, there's no question about it. Yeah. I mean, this is a guy who walks a lot of batters sometimes. I mean, this guy can throw 100 pitches within 4 innings, sometimes 5 innings. So you hope that he can get it together. He was told by Mike Maddux to slow the game down. Hopefully that philosophy will work and he can pitch at least 7 innings and be consistent on the mound.
When you look at that bullpen, Bill, Papelbon 4-for-4 as far as saves go. Is what happened late last year, is that now a complete distant memory with him on this roster and how this team started off?
Tim, you know, it's never been a story since spring training. I mean, yeah. It's over because, as you know, Harper and Papelbon settled their differences after the season ended. So by the time he got to spring training, the players weren't even talking about it. The issue was the fans. And, you know, yeah, with the fans now, you hear some boos, but there are some cheers as well because they know that Papelbon can do the job. And you know what? He's the only one right now, I feel, they can do the job as a closer on this team. And I think they made the right decision by bringing him back. So it's no issue.